Thank you so much, Asaf. Thank you to Scholars for Peace in the Middle East for inviting me to be part of this conversation. And I look forward to having the discussion, Asaf, with you and Alex. So I was asked today to share some of the insights that I have learned from the work that I have been doing with the Foundation to Combat Anti-Semitism. And in this capacity, we have really been thinking about how do we help young people, and by young people here, we're looking at the age range from 13 to about 35 years of age, to really have greater sensitivity, awareness, and to gain education about anti-Semitism, and to create some sense of sensitivity so that these individuals spanning a variety of communities in that age range have greater knowledge so that they feel the way they would feel about other forms of hatred, that anti-Semitism ought to be socially unacceptable. In order to begin sort of how we are tackling this issue, we decided to conduct some survey research. We worked with Ken Goldstein to develop a survey. We interviewed about 5,500 individuals between the ages of 13 to 35 in America, demographically representative, geographically representative, to really get a sense of what animates their concerns around social issues. And I just want to share a little bit of this with you. First of all, I want to tell you that when we ask between the ages of 13 to 35 if anti-Semitism is a problem, the answer for the majority of individuals is no. It doesn't at all compare to issues related to healthcare, climate change, possible wars with Iran, crime, cost of college tuition, racism directed specifically toward Black people, discrimination against gay people, bullying, these kinds of issues. It's way down the totem pole of priorities. Secondly, when we did ask a qualitative question in which we asked people, what is anti-Semitism? The majority of responses were IDK, meaning I don't know. And if we pushed and got some people to actually answer that question, what we found was the following. A response that was, well, I don't know what a Semite is, but I know that I'm anti-racist, and I know that I'm anti-homophobic, and I know that I'm anti-Islamophobic. So therefore, I must be an anti-Semite. So what that showed to us was that this is a term, this pseudoscientific sanitized term, that the majority of young people really have no idea what it means. And when we tested hatred of Jews or Jew hatred, we got much clearer answers in terms of people being able to identify what it is, but it still did not register as one of the major concerns. I would argue that both, whether it was anti-Semitism or the term hatred of Jews, we found that an overwhelming number of individuals, close to the 45% range, just don't know what it is. So our approach has really been thinking about, if you have a spectrum of people, our target audience are the people in the middle, the don't knows. And that's who we are trying to reach. But our strategic approach is to reach these individuals by creating digital content and social media content, by putting anti-Semitism in conversation with other forms of hatred, racism, Islamophobia, homophobia, so that individuals have a sense of an underlying foundation where these forms of hatred have a connection, even if they have their own unique characteristics. And the reason this is our approach is because we are targeting non-Jews and Jews, which therefore requires us to be able to have them identify with these issues and to be able to start to recognize some sense of care about these issues. But we also aren't necessarily approaching this in a purely scholarly educational way in which we're throwing facts and figures at individuals, but rather we're trying to root the content that we create through humanizing. We're trying to build a story that allows for a humanization component so young people can see a piece of themselves in the content that we are creating, they then can relate to that either because they identify with that particular group or because they are building their level of compassion towards people and a shared sense of humanity, and it evokes an emotion. We are not creating a litigious approach to the conversation about Jew hatred. What we also find, of course, is that it is much easier to talk about hatred towards the Jews when it comes from an ideology of white supremacy. There's a greater recognition of what white supremacy ideology is. There's a greater sense of being able to identify Jew hatred when it comes from that particular language. When individuals see a swastika, they have a sense of what that is, which is quite different than when it's coming from the hard left, where it's not always as explicit. It's not always about the trope that we know that comes from the right. And very often we see that the Jew hatred conversation is much more insidious. It's harder for young people to detect. They often label the anti-Semitism that does exist on the hard left to come from a political language. And it also, it's seen as part of the discourse of freedom of speech or academic freedom. So that's a little bit more challenging for us to be able to think about how to help younger audiences be able to identify that form of anti-Semitism when it's not as explicit and not rooted in a white supremacy ideology. And of course, the Israel conversation enters into that piece of the equation in a way that, as we all know, from some of the work that either you have been involved with directly or from some of the work that I did when I was at Brandeis, that there's not a lot of literacy about Israel. People don't know what it is. They don't know where it is. They can't identify it on the map. They don't understand the complexity of the context of the region. And so therefore you often get very simplistic, simplified messaging around the Israel conversation. And I can tell you, we see that all the time. We are actually using technology that helps us monitor what we see as the conversations that are taking place online. Using this technology, we develop queries. Those queries have key terms, key dates. We can pay attention to who's saying what on the internet. We can see how loud those conversations are and where those conversations are advancing. So today I'm looking at a screen in which it's talking a lot about not only Saeb Erekat, but also talking about Israel's recent demolition of Bedouin homes. And that is taking up a lot of space online. If you're a don't know, and you happen to be on the internet today, and you go down potentially onto a site, a news site, or if you're just paying attention to what some friends may be re-sharing, reposting, that may be a conversation that you will ultimately observe. And so the question becomes for us, how do we help provide enough scaffolding so that that don't know can actually understand and make sense of that conversation without necessarily being seduced potentially by misinformation? So that's part of the challenge that we are facing. I will add just two more pieces around this conversation. We have often found too, through some of the work that we are doing, that the term Jew by younger audiences is viewed as a slur, meaning it's seen as a very derogatory term. So we are asking ourselves, what does it mean to actually use the term Jew? And why is it perceived as being derogatory? And again, this is part of a larger conversation where Jew is seen as being only a religious group. It is seen as being part of a white sort of framework where we live in a world in which whiteness has its own challenges associated with it, particularly for the younger demographic. And so Jews, when they are trying to identify themselves, don't even know what the language is that they can use or should be using to reclaim what their identity is and to put it in a context around other minority communities that exist within the United States. The very last thing I would say, Asaf, and then happy to really open it up to a conversation, is what we found when we actually looked at how Jew was described within American society, we found that there were very warm feelings towards the Jewish description, such as friendly, intelligent, kind, innovative, warm, powerful, serious. And then at the same time, we also saw that there were other sure. So I was explaining that there were a list of phrases that we use to help describe different groups of people in American society. And we asked individuals to indicate whether or not they think any of these words describes Jews well, very well, pretty well, or not too well, not well at all. And some of these terms were things like friendly, intelligent, kind, innovative, warm. And those are very good indicators of a sense of connection to humanizing Jews. At the same time, there were also terms that Jews scored very high on, controlling, powerful, serious, dominating, and privileged. So what that is suggesting is that individuals who may not even know many Jews feel there is a perception of warmth around some of those qualities. And at the same time, there's a coolness to other aspects of those characteristic traits, which potentially can lead to a perception around Jews and a sense of anti-Semitic tropes that can play into that. So we also tested that with other populations and communities as well, including white men, including blacks, including Asian women, just to get a sense of how Jews compare in that conversation. And ultimately, the challenge for Jews is that there is a warmth towards Jews, but also a coolness in terms of the influence that Jews have in society writ large. So this is part of what we have to take into consideration as we're trying to educate young people, specifically about how Jews are, you know, are very much part of the larger landscape, that they are a minority within the larger community of minorities, and that anti-Semitism, similar to other forms of hatred, has to be understood as a form of hatred and not siloed on its own.
Great. Can you hear me, Rachel?
Yeah. I can, yeah.
Oh, great, okay, awesome. Well, thank you for that. That's wonderful and very insightful and very important into the environment that we're facing, which is obviously very challenging getting to the younger generation. As I mentioned before when Rachel began, the floor is now open. So I'm going to open up the floor to questions. And again, if you have a question, I see already some questions are coming in via the chat. You could raise your virtual hand and I'll be able to unmute you. Otherwise, you could type your question in. But before we do that, Alex, why don't you start us off and then we'll go to the other questions.
Sure. Well, thank you, as always, Rachel. I'm struck by a couple of things, and nowhere in your remarks did you say anything about the Holocaust or Holocaust education and its impact one way or another on perceptions of on anti-Semitism or perceptions of Jews. My takeaway from this is to question whether Holocaust education has a central role, let's say, in moving these issues of anti-Semitism forward. I'm also struck by your observation that very few people know anything about Israel except for bad things that they might happen to see via social media or other news sources. This suggests to me that Israel education has not perhaps been a gigantic success. But the thing that was most striking, it really is the whole concept of language and the marginalization of Jews via the strategic manipulation of language and the association of Jews with whiteness and other things that are that are now bad. And I wonder whether you want to comment about how language has been changed and is changing and has been changed strategically, tactically in the last number of years.
Yeah. So, Alex, just to start with your first point about the Holocaust, I'll just say the following very briefly. There, the young people between the ages of 13 to 17 really don't have that much Holocaust education across the country. And again, you have to factor in, we took it, you know, these are kids who go to all different types of schools across the country. It is very limited what they actually learn about the Holocaust and about World War II writ large. And some of you may have seen some of the data that came from the claims conference not so many weeks ago. And it shouldn't surprise us, and I'll use the same term that I used before, that there really isn't much literacy around Holocaust education. We do know that testimonials of survivors, testimonials of partisans, testimonials of liberators can be very powerful for all types of age groups, but it doesn't mean that that experience or that that encounter with that particular testimony is sufficient enough to be able to orient someone to understand anti-Semitism in the 21st century. And again, what I mean by that specifically is that young people describe the Holocaust as, quote, ancient history, right? It's 75 years ago since the liberation of the camps. We know that it's not ancient history, but for many in their minds, this was a long time ago. And that form of hatred has not continued to exist. And so therefore, that form of anti-Semitism is over and done with. And if they do see it, like the image of a swastika, that's what they know is wrong. But if it's not labeled with a swastika, they don't necessarily know how to define it. And so that raises real questions, Alex. It raises questions about, so what has been the impact of Holocaust education? And just to give a couple of anecdotal experiences into one short story, I've been speaking with a lot of educators who have done a ton of different professional development programs who are focused on specifically teaching about the Holocaust. And many of those educators with whom I was speaking came from the New York area. And they said, listen, if you want us to talk about what was happening in Poland in 1938 or what happened in Germany in 1942, we actually feel a great deal of confidence to be able to do so because we actually have the content knowledge and the subject matter, and we did professional development work, and we have curriculum around that, that we're able to navigate that conversation. They said, for us, the issue is when we have students who don't understand what's happening in their own neighborhoods, whether it's Brooklyn, whether it was Muncie, and they don't know how to talk about it, they don't know how to discuss it, they don't know how to make sense of it. And no Holocaust education curriculum, I don't think, is able to address that head on. So that's what I would say with regard to the piece around Holocaust education. And of course, it doesn't mean we don't teach about the Holocaust, but we need to be asking ourselves, what is the main objective and goal in doing so? With respect to the question of language, I think like all subject areas, and you know this so well, Alex, and should speak about it, language matters. And we see that terms have a different meaning than they have had in the past. And a younger generation understands terms usually through the lens of the particular moment in which they are in. Remember, this is a generation with a very short historical memory. This is a generation that is not reading the books that all of you write and read. They don't pay attention to footnotes. This is a generation that barely clicks beyond a headline. This is a generation where algorithms create and curate the content, the news, the conversations that they will be engaged in. This is a generation that spends more time online than anywhere else. That means you have less than 2 seconds to grab someone's attention for them to even click on what you are trying to get them to pay attention to. And this is a generation in which hours of content is being uploaded regularly to these social platforms. And those platforms are created purposefully for the purpose of escapism, right? People aren't going to most social media platforms in order to be inundated with subject matter knowledge. So for all those reasons, and knowing that the zeitgeist within high schools, and it's not just elite non-sectarian private high schools, it's also public high schools, and of course within the university spaces, not all but many, there is a particular zeitgeist that sees every issue refracted through the lens of the issue of race. And there are certain definitions of race that have changed over time, so that racism is now seen as an issue for through the lens of institutional racism, systemic racism. And if you are not outwardly trying to deconstruct the institutions that have perpetuated those challenges, you are seen as being part of the problem. So for many, many young Jews, they are white passing. Their Jewish identity is not what defines them in that space. And by default, because they are seen as white passing, they are ultimately guilty of being part of the system of oppression because they themselves have benefited from it and have not actively done enough to deconstruct it. So that becomes part of the challenge for young people to navigate, because they are inundated in a world at this moment in time that is creating a different understanding and construction of the term of racism. And they are ultimately assumed to be a part of the challenge rather than part of the solution.
Great. That's very important and obviously very enlightening about this stuff. So we have a lot of questions coming in. So let me start going through them, and hopefully we can tackle some of them as we go along here. So Sharon's question is related to your study, Rachel. The sample spans the age group between 13 to 35, and she wants to know if you could speak a little bit about the differences between the age groups in comparison, mostly between children and adults, as it relates to the questions that you did.
Yeah, sure. So the 13 to 17 year olds obviously spend much more time on social media. The platforms they use obviously are a bit different. They're much more in the Instagram, Snapchat, TikTok space than older audiences. Obviously 13 to 17 year olds politically they view the direction of the country in a majority of a way on the wrong track. There's a much higher disapproval rate of the current president and his administration. They do not at all understand hatred of Jews or anti-Semitism as a big problem that exists. I would say the numbers of don't knows within that 13 to 17 year old range that we're talking about, when you ask them around different issues, you know, what they know and don't know, the biggest issues they don't know about on the list that we gave them, from, you know, discrimination, racism, crime, bullying, anti-Semitism is the biggest issue that they don't know about. And also similar for hatred of Jews. Most of the younger audience also believes that that Israel is a country with a less favorable impression. So if you give, for example, Australia, England, Israel, China, Russia, Iran, Israel's closer to the China, Russia, Iran than it is to Australia and to England. And again, this shouldn't surprise us. This is also a group that hasn't had as much educational framing around these issues. They aren't involved in studying some of the subject matter yet. 13 to 17 year olds don't really, you know, you don't get world history until 10th grade. You don't get US foreign policy until 10th or 11th grade. So it shouldn't surprise so many of us. And again, in terms of, you know, that particular age group, they're much more concerned about their friends. They're much more concerned about their social life. And it's a snapshot. It's a snapshot in a moment of time and where young people are. So that's what I would say. Whereas 18 to 35 year olds, you get some more sophistication in some of these issues. But again, the largest group is don't knows around issues related to anti-Semitism, hatred of Jews. They don't know what it is, whereas they have some sense of understanding of those other issues, whether it's racism, homophobia, whatever it may be.
Great. Thank you. All right. I'm going to try to combine two questions here, one by David Rosenberg and one by Scott Aaron, and see if we can tackle them both. One relates to, of course, suggestions of changing the intellectual arguments into emotional connections. Scott obviously wants to know a little bit more about, I guess also related to that tension, how do we communicate with Jews whose religion is liberalism rather than Judaism, and deal with intersectionality and with the younger people as well? So, I mean, maybe you want to kind of try to combine both of them into kind of dealing with the emotional and the content-wise, but also trying to get to them as far as reaching them and making them understand what the issues are.
Yeah, I think, as someone who's a trained historian, I obviously deeply care about history. I deeply care about how information is presented. I deeply care about context. So by no means would I say that should ever be manipulated. It shouldn't. But rather than lead with that, it's about humanizing those stories, humanizing all of those issues so that it's not just a brain dump of facts and figures. Especially at least for the platform that I have to at least begin the conversation with these young people, I'm beginning the conversation in the worst space there possibly is, which is the internet, where there are black and white positions, people are yelling at each other. There is a real lack of being curious, people who are willing to show complexity, being willing to change their opinions, and end their sentences with question marks. So that's not an easy space to have that conversation. It's much easier, I would say, in an educational framework, whether that's in the classroom, whether that's in an experiential education setting. And so individual scholars have a better chance, I think, because of a dialogical relationship with the students, to be able to engage in a more deep and meaningful and substantive way. The work that we do is we are at least trying to begin to expose students, to expose young people who are in that don't know framework. Remember, I'm not hitting the detractors. I'm not trying to reach the people who hate Jews. I'm not interested in spending my time in that space. I'm also not reaching the people who already know something. Of course, anything we create as an organization, they can use, but they already exist. People already buy into what they are selling. I'm really trying to reach the broader audience in the middle. So if I were in marketing, I would be doing a terrible job because I'm trying to sell a product like Coke to people who only drink water. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to sell to this age group of don't knows that they should have greater sensitivity around these different groups of peoples, Jews being one of them, and introduce them either through historical moments, individuals who really exemplify moral courage, individuals who have stood for something, that are able to talk about complex issues, people who have had an impact on society writ large, but through a warm and compassionate type of framing. What we realize is that there's a sense that in general, the don't knows value their friends more than they value usefulness. So we're not trying to talk about, look at the American Jewish impact of X person, right? The American Jews impact on by this person on society writ large, because that won't work, but rather to really humanize the individuals and show how those individuals are both rooted in something that's unique to them, but also go beyond their own particularism to have an impact on the universal. So that's how we're trying to do this. And that's not an easy thing to do, and we don't know how successful that will be, but that's the approach that we are taking, in the initial sort of work that we're doing. What was the second question, Asaf?
The second question dealt with, the religion, when really the religion for some of these Jews is liberalism and the aspect of intersectionality, which again speaks to your point about the individualism, particularism versus universalism. But maybe you want to talk about that a little bit more as far as how that has become a hurdle as far as digesting this information.
So I think it has become a hurdle, but it is exactly the approach that I think is the right approach to take. So I'm a big believer that for all other minority communities, they are encouraged to look at the people who are coming from within their own community, the particular context of that community, the history of that community, the identity formation moments that have happened because of the cares they have, and they come from a place of advocacy from that community. No one diminishes that. So it's never surprising when, you know, Blacks and African Americans and people of color advocate on behalf of their own community, when women and around gender issues, people are advocating on behalf of their own community. And yet it is perceived as being abnormal or odd when Jews advocate on behalf of their own community. And that is, I think, often is because, again, especially in the American context, Jews are viewed as a confessional identity, as a religious identity. There has been a real lack of education around Jews as a people, as a tribe, as a collective, and what that means in terms of then how Jews engage. It also then plays into why Jews are not viewed as having a desire for self-determination and the discussion around Zionism. So I think there's a real opportunity in many of our educational settings, not just in the university, but whether it's in different types of public schools, private schools, day schools, Jewish educational settings, to really think about how do we reclaim the complexity of Jewish identity and also show that the Jewish identity is not monolithic, that there are a variety of influences, and that white passing narrative can't suffice as a generalization. Also that Jews all come from a higher socioeconomic status. That being said, when Jews encounter that conversation, particularly in the educational environment, it is very hard for many of them to navigate it. They don't know how to have that conversation. When they open up their kitchen cabinet and see it filled with anything they can imagine, it is like manna from heaven. So they don't have a comfort level in discussing those issues. And I would say that part of the conversation needs to happen around the family table. It needs to happen in the car with your kids. It needs to be happening when you're in those moments in your own home in which you can begin to create spaces to ask those critical questions. And that's something that I don't think many feel a level of comfort doing within even the Jewish community.
As a segue to that, and really, I think, a question that comes to mind, obviously, and looking at the data that you collected, how do you, was the information, was any kind of revealed as far as the tension or the kind of dissecting between the understanding of anti-Semitism and racism, where there are two separate issues? And were there any bridges or any data that you found in the data in what you collected that helps us bridge those gaps, given the fact that there seems to be a separation in how racism is seen as in the Americas today, and anti-Semitism is a separate issue, obviously related to everything you talked about regarding Jewish identity? Are there any kind of lights or any kind of areas that we can focus on to bridge those gaps?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we didn't do, if I were to do a survey again, I would want to do some more of that particular work, Asaf. We didn't do that. I will say that what we find is that within the Black and Hispanic communities, both in the 13 to 17 year olds, as well as the 18 to 35 year olds, that is when you have the higher rates of both higher rates of don't knows in terms of understanding some of these issues, and more strident positions around strong feelings against Israel. And so it does raise a question. We didn't break that down by different religious groups within the Black and Hispanic communities. We really just looked at those communities in broader strokes. But it does raise some questions around, again, the points of entry for Jews in those conversations with those communities, meaning where are the Black and Hispanic communities engaging with Jews? Are they engaging with Jews? How does that engagement take place? Where does Israel come into the conversation, right? Obviously, if it's a Black community who's part of the Islamic tradition, you're going to have a different orientation politically towards Israel than a Black Christian community that tends to be more evangelical. So there's more research that would need to be done, obviously, to break this down more fully. But those particular minority groups have a greater lack of both exposure to Jews. And when I say exposure to Jews, I mean Jews, Judaism, Israel, and also stronger feelings of both don't know and anti-Israel type narratives.
Great, thank you. Let me go back to our audience, which has a lot of questions, of course, which is great. A question by our friend Charles Jacobs, relates to the priority, and something of course many of us, all of us, have discussed in the past. Is it defending Israel and Jews, or deconstructing postmodernism, which drives the Jew hatred? Anything on those lines?
Yeah. Hi, Charles. I would say that, as Charles knows very well, it's not an either or. They're both necessary, and neither alone is sufficient. Meaning, if you're only talking about Israel, if you're only engaging in a discourse in which Israel is being defended, if you're only talking about BDS issues, then you're constantly on the defensive. And you ultimately aren't able to really, I think, make serious strides in both education and also in terms of people's public opinion long term. Some of these other issues related to the influence of intellectual factors that have contributed to the hostility on campuses and high schools, I'd say in even more mainstream politics and in the media, those issues, which go well beyond the conversation about Israel, but absolutely Israel is the lightning rod for those conversations. I mean, just read any of Mati Friedman's posts, from Tablet Magazine over the course of the last several years, where he talks about the way in which the media portrays Israel and the underlying factors that contribute to that portrayal. So that's not about the way Israel behaves. That's not about the way Israel engages in international diplomacy. That's not about the challenges within, Israeli society. That is about the way in which Westerners have framed these conversations. And we know that universalism, postmodernism, forms of Marxism, issues related to colonialism, all of those factors are extremely relevant in terms of how individuals see the issues that they are encountering or observing, and then how they then make sense of the world. And if we do not deconstruct some of that larger framework, which to my knowledge, no one has done in a systematic way that's accessible and digestible to a broad audience to really make sense of the world and understand what is happening and why it's happening, then these issues, I think, will continue to persist.
So and thank you for that. Obviously, very, this is the crux of a lot of the issues we've all been tackling. Regarding your last point, Robert Sofer is asking, so really, what are the next steps? How can the general Jewish population, how do we tackle these issues as far as the larger Jewish community, and what needs to be done in a more widespread way, given the sampling that you've done and what many of us see and have been observing over the past few decades, to really, to tackle some of these problems that we are finding now?
I mean, I would want to tap all of the brain power that's participating both on this call and SPME and other organizations who understand what's really happening writ large within our humanities and in Western liberal values that we see very much under attack. And that's not about a political position. That's not about a particular candidate. This is really about critical thinking skills. And we see that the younger you go, the less critical thinking skills you are actually being taught. You're being taught not how to think, but what to think. And this is a big challenge in education. So I do think we need to find a way to deconstruct many of these ideas. I have said for a long time, Alex and Asaf, you've heard me say it, that there needs to be a new text called Reorientalism, and we need to be thinking about how to write that. But then again, it shouldn't stay in a version that only feels comfortable for academics, but rather how do you take that framework and apply it into educational settings, apply it into the conversations that people are having at their water coolers to help expose some of the absurdity and hypocrisy that exists. And I would welcome, you know, a thinking collaboration with individuals who would want to make that top of mind, because I think we have to do this through very good storytelling using comedy and irony and humor. I think we need a lot of humor to expose some of this, but I haven't seen anyone do it. And then we have to figure out, so then how do you take those big ideas? How do you take that reorientation? And then apply it in a way that will grab someone's attention in 2 seconds, so that when they see that static post online, so when they read something, they actually have that in their mind in order to be able to think about recalibrating how they make sense of what the information is they're taking in.
Right. So obviously, you know, we're here to help, you know, whatever it takes. You know, this is it takes a village, and I think it's obviously critical that we can help out with that any way we can. But let me throw it back to Alex. I know, Alex, you had some other questions you wanted to ask Rachel as well while we're here.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm intrigued when you point out that that younger people, and you surveyed down to about 13, is that?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't actually know very many 13-year-olds at this point myself, but fortunately, my perception in general that is that thanks to the internet and social media and the environment generally, that children's attention spans are getting shorter and shorter. And I was very much struck by your 2 second comment. But I wonder so what you're really pointing at is in part a structural problem within the nature of contemporary education, K through 12, which is content free, emotion rich, and oriented towards what your kids are. Your kids are much younger than mine, so you're in a better position to answer that. But as you say, the zeitgeist is oriented towards shorter and shorter bits and bytes. So how to approach? I mean, are we in sales? Is it a marketing problem, really? How to make a pitch in 2 seconds? It's not even an elevator pitch. It's a tweet. It's not even a tweet. Or are we really looking at a fundamental crisis in education as a whole at every single level?
Look, I mean, Alex, I think we are looking at a fundamental crisis at education as a whole. And at the same time, I think that we are talking about a generation that is the me generation. It's the selfie generation. It's the kids, and really I'm being as clear as I can be. Cheryl Turkle's work has showed this. MIT's research for the Center of Innovation has shown this. Facebook itself was able to show this on their own research, even though they then hid it, that you know, social is being used for the purpose of young people creating a sense of perfectionism about their identity, about their social life. And there is a huge fear of missing out by these young people every time they aren't in attendance at one of the events that they know their friends is attending, and then it's blasted all over TikTok and wherever. You're talking about people who spend hours, literally hours, rehearsing a five-step dance so that it looks like perfection on TikTok with editing skills, because everyone has editing capabilities on their phone. Now, I say all of that in a very critical way, while at the same time saying, young people are deeply seeking connection. This is the loneliest generation. We see the highest rates of mental health disorders and mental crises. We see a high rate of suicide. We see a real desire to be a part of community, which is why individuals are seeking that place of meaning, and why I'm concerned about the don't knows, is because I don't want them to find community in extremist positions. I don't want them to go down the rabbit hole of finding community because they become part of ISIS or ISIL or a white supremacist organization. So the question for me becomes, how do we find a way to give young people deep, meaningful connection that is substantive? Because I think people do want substance. I think that they realize that social is superficial, but at the same time, using and leveraging social for the good that it can have, which is limited, but it can have, in order to deepen those connections and those relationships. But I would like to get young people off of the devices, because we know it is changing the way the brains are wired, and get them into relationships that are much more meaningful and can engage with some of these complex issues. We know that young people want complexity. We know that they actually thrive when they are in an environment that allows them to engage in critical thinking. We know that they are seeking brave spaces and not safe spaces so that they can ask the challenging questions. But in order to do all of those things, you also need individuals who are grown-ups to be able to navigate that with them. You need those individuals to be able to create and construct that space for them. And you need them as grown-ups to model for them how to do that. And I'm going to say something that I don't mean to be contrarian or disrespectful to any of the individuals who are on this call, and you both know me very well to know that, but there are many, especially who are academics, who tell young people, do not rock the boat, who tell young people, keep your voice down, just do your work, don't question what the administration is saying. And if those are the role models for these students, it is highly problematic. So we have to do a lot of things on multiple fronts. There is no silver bullet, but we can't just say that any of this is a lost cause and throw our hands up. Not that you're saying to do that, Alex, but I really think it's a multi-pronged effort.
So a lot to be done for sure. Let me go back to, in the little time we have, try to take a few more questions, unless you have a follow-up, Alex, or.
Please, let's get as many people involved as possible.
Okay. Technologically, of course, a question here by Yiftach Levy, who's asking about memes to combat anti-Semitism. Are there, apropos, I don't think, he's being serious about that. Are there ways that, we'll reach out to this younger generation, which, as you said correctly, lives online and looks for perfection? Are there messages online or symbolisms that, we could adopt as far as this medium that would work, that would resonate, obviously, because books don't matter, libraries don't matter, it's all about the instantaneous infotainment that we live on. Did that come up at all in some of the data that you got back?
It didn't come up in the data, but it absolutely is part of our larger thinking in terms of what kind of messages can you put out there, whether it's through memes, whether it's through influencers, who are the right influencers for which community, because you actually have to create some differentiation, meaning what you may say to a community who has absorbed ideas from the ideology of Farrakhan needs to be said in a different way, and the messenger needs to be different than, let's say, the white kid who lives in suburbia who is dabbling in white supremacy, right? So you need different types of messages. You need to have different ways in which to share those messages, and you need different messengers for each of those messages. So it's something we're very much thinking about. We do not have a solution to this. I would venture to say that no one has a solution to this. But again, I go back to humor is going to be a key element in that approach. It has to be.
Agreed. Let me take Michelle's question. And I was also asking, again, we haven't tackled that yet, but obviously a major factor, you know, how these challenges have been exacerbated by COVID due to the need for social distancing, obviously physically and spending more time online. How do we navigate through the challenge of building relationships when all this is being done virtually? You know, so that's Michelle's question.
Yeah, it's a real question, Michelle. It's a real challenge. COVID also, of course, not only creates the challenge of the social distancing and the having to stay away from some of the educational frameworks or educational institutions that students are part of, more time at home, more isolated, and more time online, but also in terms of the conspiracy theories around COVID, which have amplified some of the anti-Semitic messaging that many of us have seen or encountered over the last several months. So it is a real challenge. I mean, I think the only thing to note is that even though more and more people are online, I will say I have seen some positive trend in seeing that there are more and more young people who are looking to engage with some sort of serious content. And I'll just use as an example, and obviously this is a self-select group of students, but I have been teaching in a variety of programs over the course of, I'd say, since late spring to the present, in which those organizations have been offering really substantive educational content for high school students around Zionism, around Israel, around Jewish history, around Jews in the Middle East, and also the history of anti-Semitism. And I'm getting all different types of students who are attending these programs. And I'll tell you, the majority of these students are not coming from, you know, the Northeast or from California. They're really coming from very small cities in the Midwest and in the South, where there are very small Jewish communities who are looking to find, first of all, other Jewish kids who look like them, who talk like them, where they can build a relationship with them, and substance. They're not looking just for a social outlet. It doesn't mean a social outlet isn't created, but they actually want the content to drive the conversation. So I find that to be a very positive. I will also say that there are a lot of young people who are becoming very socially engaged and active around a variety of societal issues that this country is facing. And I would say that's a real opportunity for us to think very strategically about how to build in the anti-Semitism conversation and how to help sensitize young Jewish students to put anti-Semitism in those conversations around other forms of hatred where they often aren't necessarily including them. So there are opportunities to do this. We know that this moment hopefully will pass sooner rather than later, so that we can get people in conversation with one another, back in person with one another, in order to remove some of this distance, both metaphysically and physically, that everyone is feeling.
Great. Well, thank you for that. I'm just being cognizant of the time, and I want to be, you know, I know we didn't get to all the questions, but, you know, let me throw it back at you, Rachel and Alex, you know, as far as final thoughts. You know, obviously this is there's a lot here. There are no silver bullets. There are no magic bullets to all of these issues, but, you know, kind of going forward with all this information that we, you know, we appreciate you sharing and with everybody this afternoon, but just some final thoughts, you know, where next, and where we can be involved and how we can help move the needle a little bit.
I think that for all the folks who are especially on this call, for those of you who are teaching students, you know, there's a real opportunity to make yourself available in as much of a way as you can possibly intellectually to help create really fertile ground for that intellectual curiosity and to really push students to think about critical thinking skills, you know, whether people realize it or not. When you're in the academy, when you're in an organizational leadership position, you are looked up to and you become the grown-up of choice that young people are turning to. And so I really think we all have a responsibility to use and to recognize the influence and the power that we hold in order to be able to positively predispose young people to those critical thinking skills, the complexity of issues. I would also say that even though I just said how people spend more and more time online and 2 seconds of attention and every hour on YouTube, 400 hours of content is placed, that's what we're competing against. And I would say, so how do we take these really big ideas that animate us, these big questions around identity formation, and how do we make them accessible to a younger audience for them to be able to engage? And I think young people want that. I think they're seeking that, but I don't think that we necessarily have figured out how to deliver that. And I don't think that's just a marketing question, Alex. I actually think it's a delivery mechanism question. And so we as a community should be thinking more deeply about that. And the last thing I would say is that we know that experiences and putting young people in an experiential setting with different types of individuals has serious transformative ability. So how do we create those opportunities so that through relationships, individuals can really begin to see that differences exist, those differences can be celebrated, and those differences can help us navigate through a very complex world, but in a way that allows us to see the opportunity and the shared humanity that I think we all deeply possess.
Well, thank you for that. I know, and obviously, you know, this is a work that all of us need to be part of, and this is really the future of the next generation on these on every level of these issues. Alex, a few any final words from you before we wrap up this afternoon as well?
No, actually, I think Rachel summed it up very nicely and leaves things on a very positive and hopeful note. So why don't we leave it there? It's the top of the hour, so we're right on schedule for a change too.
Exactly. So we need positive and we need hopefulness. So Rachel, really, I know I want to thank you as always for all the work you do, for your friendship, and for everything that you know you're doing for the people at large. And we are here as always to help and participate and partner any way we can to pass on, to help and mobilize as far as these issues. So I really want to thank you again for taking the time to talk to us this afternoon. Very important and very impactful as far as the information you have. And so we obviously will wait, you know, if there's more data that comes in, you know, obviously share that with us and we can, you know, pass that on to all our members. So I want to thank you again. Thank Alex as always. I want to thank everybody who joined us this afternoon. This is obviously a part of our continuation of our conversations that we will be continuing next week as well with our next speaker, Amos Giora. So look forward to that notice that will be going out shortly. So thank you again, everybody, and have a good afternoon.
Thank you.